I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. Well, what happens when a private contractor starts doing the same work as American military and spy agencies? That's the question people are asking today after the New York Times reported that the controversial private security firm Blackwater worked side by side with the CIA in secret raids on suspected insurgents in Iraq and Afghanistan. Blackwater, which is now called Z Services, denies it was under contract to take part in the covert raids, but the firm has come under fire in the past for its work in Iraq and Afghanistan, specifically for a 2007 shooting in Baghdad that left 17 Iraqis dead. And joining us now is Mark Mazzetti of the New York Times. He reported today's story. And Mark, first of all, what exactly did you find that the Blackwater guards were doing on these covert operations?
What we reported in the story is that Blackwater guards accompanied CIA officers around Iraq and Afghanistan on counterterrorism missions. And what we said is that it grew out of an initial contract with CIA to provide security for the CIA bases in those countries. But then it sort of morphed beyond this, what they call static security, into mobile security, accompanying CIA officers around, and eventually participating in actual snatch-and-grab operations against suspected militants. So it's they may not have been officially under contract for the raids. However, in the heat of battle and on the ground, they took a very direct operational role in some of these missions.
So they were actually going in, participating, grabbing people, removing them, et cetera.
Yes, as we understand it, it was a pretty ad hoc operation over there in the sense as intelligence would come in about suspected militants and as operations were planned, some of these security guards, the Blackwater contractors, many of them who had military backgrounds, were brought into the planning.
Mm-hmm. Well, Blackwater issued a statement today basically denying your report. They're saying that Blackwater was never under contract to participate in these covert raids.
Well, that's right. And we didn't report in the story that there was a contract officially to do this. As we said, the contract that they had with the CIA was to provide security for initially the CIA base in or station in Baghdad and Kabul, but it's also to provide security for CIA officers. But in practicality, what happened was wherever the officers go, the Blackwater guards went as well, and that included on missions to go after the insurgents.
And so what exactly is wrong with that? I'm not sure at what point this becomes a suspected issue.
Well, it's the question is, you know, to what extent does the U.S. want to have guns for hire on the battlefield, performing missions that are traditionally the role of the U.S. military or the American intelligence officers? No one is alleging that it is illegal, in part because the law is so murky about exactly what a government employee can and cannot do. So what we've seen in the last 9 years since September 11th, 8 years since September 11th, is a proliferation of contractors doing jobs that traditionally American government employees did.
Hmm. Do you have a sense as to how high up the chain of command at the CIA knowledge of this, the Blackwater participation in these operations went?
Well, it was certainly approved at the highest levels inside of, you know, the CIA stations in Kabul and Baghdad. And it's unclear exactly whether this was blessed by senior officers, CIA officials in Washington. As we reported in the story, in early 2005, a cable went out from headquarters at CIA to the field, specifically Baghdad, that CIA officers are not allowed to go outside of the station without a Blackwater security guard. And so that was one thing that helped the mission of Blackwater morph inside of Iraq to a much more operational role, but it may not have been approved, per se, by the senior CIA officials in Washington.
Hmm. So there's been a lot of reporting recently or over the past many months about what Blackwater has been allegedly doing with the CIA. Do you get any sense that, the CIA is maybe reassessing its relationship with this company?
Yes. As we said in the story, CIA Director Liam Panetta has instituted a review of Blackwater contracts to sort of make sure that they're not operational contracts. They are what they're supposed to be, traditional security contracts. We're told that the CIA has severed its ties with Blackwater in Iraq, just as the State Department has. However, the CIA still uses Blackwater in Afghanistan and Pakistan in a number of roles. We reported in August that they help operate the CIA Predator program from bases in Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Mark Mazzetti with the New York Times. He broke today's story about Blackwater contractors taking place in secret CIA raids in Iraq and Afghanistan. Mark, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Well, tucked into the Senate health care bill, at a little past page 1900, there's a new program. It's called the CLASS Act, and that's short for Community Living Assistance Services and Support. It's a new government-run insurance plan for long-term care, meaning an insurance plan you could buy into, which will pay you cash when you need it, for things like nursing homes or maybe, for example, if you were disabled and needed professional home care to do things like eat and bathe. The program was introduced by the late Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy. And both critics and supporters, for different reasons, say that it promises to transform the way we think about caring for people who need long-term help. So what exactly is in this new provision, and what are its chances of making it through the already fraught negotiations over health care? With us is veteran journalist Howard Gleckman. He's author of the book Caring for Our Parents. And Howard, this proposal has already survived a tough vote in the Senate. And before we get to the details of what's being discussed, why don't we get a better handle on what exactly long-term care means? It's not necessarily medical care per se. So what are we talking about when we say long-term care?
Long-term care is the care that people with chronic illness need to live the best possible quality of life that they can. It's not medical care, as you say. It's help bathing, it's help getting to the doctor, it's help getting to the bathroom. This is usually provided at home. While people think about long-term care in the context of nursing homes, 90% of people get their care at home.
Meaning that you could also be young and disabled.
Absolutely. This applies to people who have automobile accidents, who are suffering from chronic diseases such as multiple sclerosis. Absolutely. About 60% of people who require long-term care are over 65, but the rest are younger.
So it seems like what's caught people's attention about this proposal, this CLASS Act, is that it's a voluntary government-run insurance program that would give some kind of limited cash benefit. So why don't you tell us what's specifically in this provision?
Sure. And let me actually start by telling you a little bit about how we pay for this now. Typically what happens is American families pay for long-term care out of their own pockets. It's hugely expensive. Nursing home care is $75,000 or $80,000 a year. Home health aides are $15 or $20 an hour. They pay for it out of their own pocket until they run out of money, and then they end up on Medicaid, which is a government welfare-like program that provides more than 40 or 50% of the long-term care benefits in this country. A few people have private long-term care insurance, but very few, only about 7 million people. So what this proposal would do is it would set up a program that looks a little bit like Medicare, in that people would have the opportunity to buy a government insurance program. It would be a basic policy. It would probably pay on the average of $50 or $75 a day, although we don't know exactly how much the benefit would be. It would be a cash benefit, which is very important, and they would get it for life. As soon as they were frail enough and needed the assistance, they would get the benefit for life.
It's not limited to age or pre-existing condition or anything like that.
That's right. In the current version of the bill, there's a requirement that you pay in for at least 5 years before you can get benefits. But once you've done that, you would get the benefit for as long as you needed it. You could begin paying premiums as soon as you started working at 18 or 20. And you pay it through your working career.
So the distinction sometimes between these major government programs gets a little difficult to wrap our heads around. So what makes this CLASS Act different than an entitled program like Social Security or Medicare?
Well, of course, the main thing that makes it different is what it covers. It covers long-term care. It doesn't cover health care like Medicare does. The other big piece of it, and this really depends a lot on how it's designed, is if it is designed properly, this would be a self-financing insurance program, unlike Medicare, where we pay some premiums and we pay some payroll taxes, but much of Medicare is actually paid for through the general fund, and Social Security, which of course is underfunded. The CLASS Act could be designed to be self-funding so that this would not be another unfunded entitlement program. If it's designed poorly, It, in fact, could turn into an unfunded entitlement program, and that's what has many critics concerned.
Exactly. And on that point, I mean, I've read that one of their concerns is that it's not certain what the premiums that people who are in the program would need to pay. I've read anywhere from, you know, $65 a month to $180 a month.
That's right. One of the big questions is, who will participate? If this is a voluntary program, will young people, for example, be willing to pay insurance premiums starting at age 20 for a benefit they may not get for 60 years? Truth is, we don't know the answer to that. If young people are willing to participate, if healthier middle-aged people are willing to participate, the premiums could be relatively low. If not, premiums could be quite high. And then you get into what they call in the insurance business the death spiral, where the only people who buy are people who are sure they're going to need it. And as more and more people like that buy the insurance, the premiums go up even more.
But your argument against avoiding that insurance death spiral is to make it a mandatory program.
That's right. I've argued that this should be mandatory, that we should set up a program where everyone must buy this insurance when they start working. They would pay the premiums for their life, and they would get this very good benefit when they needed it. Mm-hmm. If you drive a car, you have to have insurance. If you own a house, you have to have insurance. You know, people say, well, why should I pay for this? Well, Medicaid is a taxpayer-funded program. You are, in fact, paying for it. And I think it's better that you pay for this as an insurance program than you pay for it as a welfare program. If it's a mandatory program, there are some rough estimates out there that suggest that the premium could be as little as $40 or $50 a month on average, even lower than that for young people.
Well, let's talk about for a second what people would actually get in return for paying these premiums if indeed the CLASS Act were to be made into law. I mean, I'm reading that if you became disabled or elderly and infirm, that you would get some $50 or $75 a day. That really doesn't sound like very much.
It depends on the situation you're in, Magna. If you are in a nursing home, $75 a day isn't very much because the average cost of a nursing home is over $200 a day. But if you're at home, $75 a day can make a big difference. It can pay for 4 hours a day of a home health aide. That takes tremendous burden off of the caregivers. A typical caregiver is a 50-year-old woman who is working, who may be trying to raise her own children while she's taking care of her mother. $75 a day may be the difference between her ability to hire an aide and still work, or having to quit her job and stay home to take care of her mom.
That's veteran journalist Howard Gleckman talking about a proposed government insurance plan to pay for long-term care. The proposal is tucked into both Senate and House health care bills, and critics like Democratic Senator Kent Conrad of North Dakota have called the plan a Ponzi scheme. When we come back, we'll ask about the costs. Coming up later in the show, a former Marine commander injured during the 1983 terrorist bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut. He'll tell us about his efforts to get compensation from Iran and why the Obama administration is trying to block the payments. Back after a break, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about a major but little-known provision in the healthcare reform bills, a new government-run insurance program to help disabled adults and elderly Americans pay for long-term care services like home health care, adult day programs, assisted living, or nursing homes. Our guest is veteran journalist Howard Gleckman. He's author of the book Caring for Our Parents. And Howard, you mentioned that if the CLASS Act, as this provision is known, were to become law, the government would collect premiums for 5 years before the first payouts would be returned to people who need them. But in that five-year period before the money is put to use, is there a plan for what the government will do with the money to protect it?
This is another really big, very controversial issue. A number of senators, including a number of Democrats, have raised the concern that you just did. What's going to happen to this money? This program is going to collect hundreds of billions of dollars over the first 10 or 20 years. And you put hundreds of billions of dollars in front of the Congress, and you know what's going to happen. So they're looking for ways to design this so that the money is kept away from the general fund. I don't think that the bill, as it's currently written, really does that very well. It would create a trust fund inside the Treasury. That's how Social Security is set up, and we've seen what's happened to the Social Security money. I would like to see them set up some kind of a quasi-government, quasi-private corporation that could absorb all these revenues and essentially act like an insurance company. It would take the premium income, it would then invest the income, just as any insurance company does, and they would pay out the claims later on. But I think they do need to find some way to keep this money out of the hands of Congress, because if Congress sees a couple of $100 billion, at best what it's going to do is use it to make it look like the deficit is less than it is. At worst, it's going to actually go out and spend the money.
I'm hearing the faint echoes of a phrase that we may have heard before, lockbox, in terms of protecting these funds.
That's right. Al Gore talked about a lockbox back in the 1990s when we thought we were going to have government surpluses, and it became a laugh line. We have to create a system that truly does protect this money, and it's not easy to do. We don't have in this country any comparable kind of a program. I think, actually, if we could do this right with class, it would be an interesting model for other kinds of entitlement programs. And maybe when we did Social Security reform, we could even look at a similar kind of a system.
I do want to dig into the real fiscal and political realities that the CLASS Act is facing in the Senate right now. It did pass the House health care bill, but it is in the Senate right now. And there's the strong criticism is definitely on the financial front. What they're saying, what critics are saying, is that it's at best, quote, a Ponzi scheme that's going to move a lot of money around. It's at worst a huge potential drain on the federal budget. Is there any sense as to how cost control could happen?
Well, I think, first of all, it's not fair to say that this is a Ponzi scheme. I think this is not some deliberate effort to con taxpayers out of money so they can spend the money for something else. However, the risk is that that could happen. But I think that they do need to design this in a way that the money is really treated like an insurance program. If they could do that, the arguments of at least some of the senators would go away. Now, there are going to be some senators, including some Democrats, who are opposed to this simply because they don't like what this would mean for the private insurance business. The private long-term care insurance companies, for the most part, are opposed to the CLASS Act, because they fear that it would take business away from them. I disagree. I think that the CLASS Act could become a basic insurance program that private insurers could then sell a supplement policy to enhance. This is the way that, for example, Medigap insurance works. You have your basic Medicare insurance, and then many, many people buy supplemental insurance. And I think the same thing could happen with long-term care insurance. You'd have your basic benefit of $50 or $75 a day. And if you wanted more, as many middle-class people do, you could then buy private insurance that would wrap around that public policy.
Howard, by your measure, does the CLASS Act have a chance in the Senate?
I think it's got a chance. Most of what's going to happen in health reform is going to get resolved in a small room sometime early next year, between the House leadership, the Senate leadership, and the White House. There are provisions that will appear in that bill that we have never seen before, and then there are other provisions, like the CLASS Act, that are in both the House and Senate bills that may or may not survive. I think, though, it's got about a 50-50 chance of making it, and frankly, if it doesn't make it this year, I think it's inevitable that sometime over the next couple of years, we're going to have to deal with this. If you look at the long-term future of Medicaid, which is a program that pays for this, it is not sustainable. We think of Medicaid as a program for young women and children, but in fact, a third of Medicaid spending right now is for long-term care. And Medicaid is ruining state budgets and putting tremendous pressure on the federal budget. So I think we need to do something about the welfare-based Medicaid program, and the CLASS Act would take enormous pressure off of that. But more importantly, what it would do is it would take tremendous pressure off of families who right now are literally going broke paying for long-term care for their loved ones.
And you've called that fact the real crisis of the uninsured in America.
It's really true. When you think about this, in the debate we're having over health insurance, people mention correctly that 40 or 50 million Americans do not have health insurance. But what they don't say is there are 250 million Americans who do have health insurance. But while there are 250 million Americans who have health insurance, there are only 7 million Americans who have long-term care insurance. And this is something that many, many of us are going to face. If you're over 65, there's a 2 out of 3 chance that you're going to require some long-term care before you die. And 20% of us are going to need long-term care for 5 years or more. Now, we don't have the financial wherewithal to pay for it. So we're either going to have to do it with something like class, or we're going to have to just acknowledge the fact that we're going to continue to have a growing welfare program that's going to pay for this when people go broke. It's not going to go away.
Veteran journalist Howard Gleckman speaking with us about the Class Act currently being debated in the Senate health care bill. He's also author of the book Caring for Our Parents. Howard, thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be with you, Megan.
Well, Monday on Here and Now, the hard work of making peace. A Massachusetts professor brings ethnic factions together in Iraq. Also, a new TV show features a cappella singing. It's a lot more than Glee. That's Monday. Still ahead today, revisiting the 1983 bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut. A Marine who was there is now battling the White House to get compensation for his injuries. Back after the news, Here and Now. Well, a dispute has emerged between the U.S. and China at the climate change talks in Copenhagen today. China's foreign minister is blasting the top American climate negotiator, Todd Stern, for comments he made yesterday. Stern said that China should not expect any U.S. climate aid money and that the U.S. was not indebted to the world for its historical carbon emissions. Matt McGraw is the BBC's science correspondent. He's in Copenhagen. And Matt, what exactly is the Chinese foreign minister saying about Stern's comments?
Well, he certainly gave a broadside in terms of response to Todd Stern. He said that the U.S. negotiator lacked common sense and was extremely irresponsible. And they weren't looking after their historic responsibility. I think both sides, the United States and the Chinese, have been snapping at each other a little bit all week. Todd Stern earlier in the week pointed out that China was sitting on $2 trillion worth of cash when asked if the United States should make some contribution to help them cope with climate change. And I think since then, the Chinese have been looking for the opportunity to get their own back.
And I also note that Stern said that the Obama administration's commitment to do something about the climate is, quote, seismic in comparison to previous administrations. But on the whole, is this scuffle going to have a damaging effect on the conference?
I think it, in some respects, sums up some of the divisions we're seeing here today. Particularly, we've had two draft documents published by the UN authorities about how they'd like to see this negotiation finish in a week's time. And there's been, you know, a mixed reaction. Some of the developed countries, the richer countries, the United States, Europe, not happy with some of the provisions in these documents. The poorer nations, the developing countries, unhappy about the financial provisions, particularly in these documents. So I think the US-China spat, in some respects, even though a lot of the time they're on the same page, it does reflect some of the underlying tensions between North and South, East and West here.
Well, what exactly was revealed in those draft documents that were released?
I think the key thing about those draft documents is the fact that there were two of them. Richer nations, United States and Europe and others, have been arguing that there should be one agreement that comes out of here that pulls together the Kyoto Protocol, pulls together the idea of long-term action, brings the United States into the picture in one kind of level playing field for everybody. What seems to be the case here is that the developing countries are very keen on keeping the Kyoto Protocol as it is, and in the documents that are published today, it looks like that's going to continue. There's going to be a second commitment period for the Kyoto Protocol from 2012. Running alongside that will be another document, another agreement perhaps, on long-term cooperative action, which would bring in the United States. It's a little bit messy in terms of how it will all work, but the developing countries see this as very important. They keep the Kyoto Protocol running, and the richer countries a little bit unhappy that they are not going to get one document, they're going to get two. So an awful lot of things are in brackets, an awful lot of things that remain unagreed. But these are kind of the outline architecture of what might come out of here.
So it's something like Kyoto Plus, with the draft document calling for greenhouse gas emissions to be cut by some 25% to 45%. From 1990 levels by 2020, if I understand correctly.
That's right, yes. I mean, the long-term cooperative action document looks at the idea that the climate change should be limited to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2 degrees Celsius, and both those numbers in there. To get there, it says there should be 50% minimum cuts of emissions by 2050. And to get there, you need the richer developed countries to do 25% minimum by 2020. Now, if you look at what's on the table at the moment, what the richer countries have offered, that adds up to about 17%, 18% maybe. So there's quite a gap between those two numbers. How they bridge that over the next few days, well, that's when the leaders will arrive in town, and I think that's what they'll be kicking around between them this time next week.
And finally, I mean, there's this ongoing discomfort, as you've mentioned, between the richer countries and the poorer countries, but we also hear that Europe has announced that the European Union is going to pay some $3 billion a year, or making a financial commitment to those so-called poorer countries, this agreement being led by France and Britain, to assist those poorer countries in paying for climate change technology. technologies and initiatives. What's the reaction there to that?
Again, it depends on who you talk to. The richer countries think this is a great step forward. They like the idea of this being operational from the 1st of January next year, and they think that that is a good way of getting the developing countries to sign up because there's an offer of pretty much instant cash. They think $10 billion per year is a reasonable amount to put forward in the first place. The poorer countries, the developing countries, they think nothing of the sort. They think it's exactly the opposite. In fact, one of the leader of the group, the G77 as it's called, earlier this week, said that that money, the $10 billion, wouldn't buy coffins for people in Africa. It was too little.
Well, Matt McGrath is the BBC's science correspondent. He's speaking to us from the Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen. Matt, thank you very much. And in just 30 seconds, a former Marine who was at the Beirut bombings in 1983 says the White House is interfering with his efforts to get compensations for the injuries he received. It's Here and Now. In October 1983, a 19-ton suicide truck bomb exploded at the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut, Lebanon. 241 American service members died in the attack, the deadliest on the United States at the time. The FBI has called the Beirut bombing the largest non-nuclear bomb explosion on Earth ever. But it wasn't until after September 11, 2001, that Congress passed a law that enabled victims' family members and survivors of terrorist attacks to seek legal restitution. In 2003, a U.S. District Court judge in Washington, D.C. ruled that although the attack was carried out by the Lebanese Shiite terrorist group Hezbollah, Iran was responsible for planning and facilitating the Beirut bombing. The same judge awarded the plaintiffs $2.65 billion in damages in 2007. The survivors and family members haven't yet received a dime of the money because recently the Obama administration went to court trying to block those payments, saying seizing Iranian assets wouldn't be in the best interest of current U.S. diplomatic efforts with Iran. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Robert Gates said today that the U.S. will soon impose, quote, significant additional sanctions on Iran for its unwillingness to engage in discussions about its nuclear program. Well, joining us from Washington is Tom Fay. He's a lawyer representing hundreds of surviving family members and direct victims of the 1983 attack in Beirut. Welcome to Here and Now, Tom.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And with you, Tom, is one of your clients, Lieutenant Colonel Howard Gerlach. He was a battalion commander in charge of about 1,200 Marines in Beirut at the barracks. Lieutenant Colonel Gerlach, welcome.
Well, thank you.
And Lieutenant Colonel, if I can, let me begin with you. I mean, it's been 26 years since that day, and if you could you take us back to what happened?
The morning of the bombing, I remember getting up my normal time, which is somewhere around 5 or so, and walking around the headquarters building, checking posts, going and talking to the Marines, and I had gone back up to my room. And I remember being in my room and hearing what I thought were gunshots and looking out the window, and then I don't remember anything more. I suffered a concussion, and that knocked me out of the loop for a while.
So it was early in the morning. Most of the Marines were still asleep. This massive explosion happens. You wake up days later, apparently, and what had happened to you?
Well, I had suffered a few broken bones and a spinal cord injury. A broken neck was the most serious injury.
Your spinal cord injury has left you in a wheelchair?
Yes, I use a wheelchair, and I use crutches also to get around, you know, mostly for exercise.
Well, it's 26 years later, and now you're relying on a wheelchair. You're partially paralyzed. What made you decide to pursue this court case against the nation of Iran?
Well, when I was contacted about it, of course, I went through some thought processes, and I thought that one, justice hadn't been served, and we needed some accountability, and maybe this could act as a deterrent for any future terrorist nations or nations that want to sponsor terrorism. Yeah, I mean, we're not going to war with them, and this is a more humane way to drive at some sort of justice.
Well, Lieutenant Colonel Gerlach, you know, now we hear that the Obama administration, the Justice Department, is actually trying to block those payments based on a diplomatic argument. You know, what's your response to that?
I can't understand it. It doesn't compute in my mind that you can have support sanctions on one hand and be against the collection of damages on the other hand. They're all aimed at the same thing, to stop the terrorism that is being supported by Iran.
And Tom Fay, if I can turn to you briefly.
Certainly.
You're a lawyer representing these families and these servicemen who survived this attack. What's your response to the Justice Department's move here?
I don't know what could be more harmful to the reputation of the United States worldwide than to have its government act to prevent these families from collecting their losses from a terrorist attack. I don't know how whoever decided on this policy could believe that any American citizen or foreign government, for that matter, would trust the United States in the future if the United States government abandoned these men who deserve to have the support of the United States government. The present Secretary of State, Hillary Rodham Clinton, was one of the members of the United States Senate who co-sponsored legislation in 2008 to facilitate collection. Another co-sponsor of that was now Vice President Joe Biden. So that makes the foreign relations situation, their opposition, even stranger, let's say, is the point.
I guess the problem is that even in other cases in the past, the payments haven't been made. I mean, from what I understand is that there have been judgments against Iran for supporting terrorist groups like Hezbollah and Hamas and Islamic Jihad. And those other judgments total some $10 billion. But collecting the money has never been easy. So has it played out any differently in the past than the challenges you guys are facing today?
In every case that I have handled, we have collected every dime in compensatory damages. So there have been collections. There haven't been a lot of attempts, unfortunately, by other counsel, other parties, to enforce on these judgments. And it is a lot of work, and it can be very discouraging. But I would encourage any attorney listening to this that has one of these cases to search for their assets and run them down and collect on the case.
Lieutenant Colonel Gerlach, if I can just turn back to you here for a moment. Say that you did get the settlement, or maybe even if you didn't, for you as a survivor of this bombing, how do you think you're going to come to feeling closure about this?
Well, I don't think that true justice has been served unless they are forced to pay what our judicial system, which is the most just in the entire world, contrary to what some would believe on that side, until that has been enforced. I mean, I grew up with the saying, crime doesn't pay. They committed an international crime. They committed an act of war against our country. There was no declaration of war. We were on a peacekeeping mission. And I certainly would not be part of this if I thought it was going to hurt our country.
Well, Lieutenant Colonel Howard Gerlach is a United States Marine, and he was at the 1983 bombing in Beirut at the U.S. Marine Barracks. Lieutenant Colonel Gerlach, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Magna.
And Thomas Fay is a lawyer representing victims' families and survivors from that attack. He's working to collect the $2.65 billion in damages levied against the country of Iran for its role in the 1983 Beirut bombing. Mr. Fay, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Well, I thank you, and we're going to go forward. And as the old football coach had to sign up, a winner never quits, a quitter never wins. They're not going to quit, and I'm not either in obtaining justice. So thanks a lot.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. Thomas Hoving, the father of the Blockbuster Museum show, died yesterday in Manhattan. He was 78. Hoving was director of New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art from 1967 to 1978. And one of the artists he featured there was one of America's most famous and controversial painters, Andrew Wyeth. You may know Wyeth from his work, Christina's World. It shows a woman in a common kitchen dress stretched out in a field. Thomas Hoving wrote three books about Andrew Wyeth, so when Wyeth died in January of this year, Here and Now's Robin Young talked with Hoving about his relationship with the painter. A warning, Hoving's language gets a little salty.
He was a dear friend and could twig me, and I could twig him, so we were two twiggers.
Well, you're also very much on the record. You say you admired Andrew Wyeth, but for all the wrong reasons.
Well, a lot of people who've been writing about him since he passed say that he was starchily sentimental. And my take on Andrew Wyeth was he'd never made a sentimental painting or drawing in his life. He was a son of a bitch. You painted son of a bitches, including me. And he painted the way a surgeon cuts into you. And that is no feeling about it. Just cut and get it and throw it out. And post-operative pains, that's your problem. And he had this vicious knife-like eye that captured things and delivered them to humanity in a way that I don't think many artists in history have done.
Well, and you've told me it's because of his eyesight.
Well, he had a fantastic vision and could see very close and far away, 2010 or whatever, the finest pilots in the world have it. And he said that's part of his success. But remarkably, the fine single brush, if there is such a thing, detail, did not overwhelm the overall subject matter. His finest things, I think, that will go down in history are the watercolors. The tempera was a very personal medium for him. He liked to hold it and feel it because it was this marvelous thing, like the building of the surface of the earth, he used to tell me. But the watercolors, these fast, swooping, incredible pieces, I think are going to become more and more famous as years go on.
Well, you also write, you're the only person he talked to about his paintings?
Joe Levine, who was a Hollywood mogul, had a great collection of his paintings, and back in the days when I was at the Met, Joe said, well, I'll give you my entire collection if you put a show of Wyeth's works on. And I said, done, kid, mm-hmm. You know. And I asked Henry Geltzahler, a very trendy, chic curator of contemporary, would he do the show? And he mm-hmm. went down and met Wyeth and began to look through the pre-studies, which nobody had ever seen except Wyeth and his wife, Betsy. And Henry Geltzahler, who was this most modern pop art guy, Andy Warhol guy, fell in love with Wyeth's work. But then he said, I've got to pull out. I said, what? Mm. He said, I got to pull out because my clique won't like it. And I said, well, I guess I better do it. And instead of a catalog, which I think is kind of dull, let me go down and talk to him about what the heck he's been doing. So I went down in his father's studio. I said, let's talk only about art. I don't care about your family or you or anybody. He said, nobody's ever said that. He opened up a bottle of red wine at 9 in the morning, and we went on from there.
Yeah. Was part of his reclusiveness perhaps anger at critics who said he was a mere illustrator?
Not in the slightest. We used to laugh about his critics, and his favorite critic who hated him was a fellow by the name of Hilton Kramer, and he wrote all of Andrew's colors were the color of merd. And Andy said, you know, why can't he come out and say shit? You know, what is this guy so effete? He can't even say the American word to the... He really left like hell about that.
Well, tell us about Christine Olsen. Maybe one of Wyeth's most famous images is of this farm woman in a kitchen dress laying in the field looking up at her house on the hill. Who was she?
Well, let me add first that one of his famous paintings, one of his really best paintings, is of a sink at Turner's Farm. The sink were this milk bucket looking like a shining silver parade armor for some great monarch in the Middle Ages. It's just sitting on the edge of this huge farm sink.
Right.
Christina was a gal. She had had a serious illness when she was young, and she could hardly get around. She was very ugly. She was very beautiful in her eyes. They really got along together magnificently. He said, people think there's this young girl crawling around in the grass, looking up at her house. He said, they have no idea that she's this old crippled person.
No.
And some of the best pictures he ever did were of her and her brother, who was equally startling looking.
Thomas Hoving, Andrew Wyeth painted you. So what was that like?
I went down in Father's studio. And he made me talk for the entire 38 hours. And it's hot, about maybe 107 in the studio. And he sits on his tiny little stool on the floor. And he begins to take off his clothes to stay cool. And I'm forced to keep mine on. I'm sweating and I'm talking. He says, I want to hear more. You got to keep talking because that's for animation. And he looked at my nostril and said, that is the basis of all the proportions that I'm going to do of you. When I do a human being, I don't do a forearm, I don't do a finger. Everybody's nostril is different from everybody else's, and it's in proportion with everything else in their body.
Huh.
So he spent a great deal of time on my nostril. And at the end of the first session, the first weekend, I said, can I take a look at it? And he said, I've never shown anything in my life that's uncompleted. And I said, come on, for God's sake. He said, oh, take a look. And there was my father. And he had never seen my father in his life. And, of course, it was the bone structure of the Hoving family that he had captured. And at the very end, he says, you know, just around now, I can wreck these things. And I said, stop, finish it, do it. You know, and he did, handed it to me. And then he told me some marvelous stories that one of his dogs, Nell, she was outside looking at him through the big window of the studio, and a squirrel was coming down a tree just behind her. And then suddenly she turns around, grabs the squirrel, and kills it. Because she was looking in the glass as a mirror. He said, I didn't know dogs could see things in a mirror. He loved the cruel. He loved blood. He you know. The only other painter that I ever knew was Francis Bacon, who said he used to get on the British police band and hear about automobile accidents, and he'd go out and take a look at the blood.
Huh. Well, I know you have your books there with Wyeth's thoughts. Combine his words with yours. What do you think his best work is?
What do I think is his best work? I think his watercolor called Wolf Moon, done in 1975, is his best work and one of the best watercolors ever made in the United States. I was up there late one night in back of the Kerner house about 1 o'clock in the morning. The moon was full and illuminated the melted patches of snow on the hill in a mysterious way. Suddenly I heard a soft, regular sound from the woodshed. It was Anna Kerner chopping wood late at night. There was only one light on in the whole house, and that was at the woodshed. God, I can still hear this chopping sound, chopping the kindling fine, very fine, putting it into a small basket to start the early morning breakfast fire. I stood there in the crisp, chill moonlight in trance. Finally, she stopped. The light in the woodshed went out, and I saw other lights go out in different windows. She went upstairs, turning them off on her way up. And then there was a silence, and only the moon and the still house below and the great expanse of the hill above it with the patches of half-melted snow in the hill. It's in their private collection. It's just totally out of sight.
That's Thomas Hoving. He was director of New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art from 1967 to 1978. He spoke with Robin Young last January about his relationship with artist Andrew Wyeth. Thomas Hoving died yesterday in Manhattan. He was 78. You can hear Robin's interview with Andrew Wyeth on our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Robin Young returns on Monday. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.